Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Don't say you were not warned. For the next 10,000 years, sightseers to a desert region near Carlsbad, New Mexico, will travel at their own risk, having been warned away by hideous architectural sculptures. Beneath the sand, 500,000 barrels of toxic waste. Also this time, standing on a box to see high over the windowsill, Delia Owens looks into the face of Survivor, the great gray elephant.
He lifts his lashes and looks directly at me. He shows neither surprise nor concern, and I stare into the gray forever of an elephant's eye.
Some of the stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. Imagine the year 5,000. You are exploring a barren desert in the southwest of the United States. You walk towards the horizon. Crude shapes begin to emerge. You enter a field of menacing thorns with sharp points extending 80 feet into the air. The granite spikes are uncomfortably close on the desert floor, crowding out curious humans. Horrified, you turn away and never return. That's the kind of reaction Professor Michael Brill is counting on. He's a professor of architecture at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He was part of a team designing the horrifying landscape as a warning to future generations.
In this particular project, the U.S. Department of Energy wants to bury 500,000 barrels of radioactive waste. And their intention is to, they have looked at many different sites, trying to find ones that somehow haven't changed for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and that probably won't change for thousands more. They are looking for sites that have very low risk of disturbing the waste that's going to be buried in them. This particular one is in the southeastern corner of New Mexico, and they intend to bury all of this radioactive waste in steel barrels. About one-third of a mile down below the desert, the waste will remain dangerous for 10,000 years. And during this period, the government has taken on the ethical responsibility to warn people of this burial site's dangers. In order to help prevent any inadvertent release of the radioactivity into our descendants' food chain and their water supply and air.
Brill developed 8 possible landscapes the United States Department of Energy could build to warn future generations away from the toxic burial sites. He says the challenge was to create something that will endure for 10,000 years.
Given this deep future of 10,000 years, what we know is that no language spoken today will be spoken 1,500 years from now, except by scholars, and that's not even 10,000 years. So that language can't really be the primary solution to this warning. The feds asked a number of groups of people to study what the cultures or what future societies might be at this site over the next 10,000 years. They had 4 different panels studying it. And the answer essentially is, well, there's going to be lots of different cultures that will exist at that site over such a long time period, and they will be wildly different. So that some of them will be very sophisticated, some of them could be very primitive. The government has also recognized that any solution that gets developed can't depend on any government control beyond 100 years from now. That is, there's just no expectation that they could sustain any kind of active commitment. It has to be a passive marker. And the last problem is that very few materials that we know can remain exposed and be durable for 10,000 years. There's a fairly limited set.
To address these problems, Brill decided to project meaning using physical forms.
What there is somehow templates in the mind of form and meaning bonded together that we call archetypes. And everybody has them everywhere. And what that means is that the people 10,000 years from now will have them as well, because they're not culturally communicated. They just come with just being human. So that the ideas that we sought were ones that essentially would warn people away or strongly suggest to people that this is a dangerous place, or that this is land that really shouldn't be lived on and used.
The landscape suggests wounding to the body and keeping something buried that should not escape. One design calls for an immense black masonry slab, creating a searingly hot landscape, uninhabitable and unarable. Another menacing earthworks form suggests emanations of danger emerging from the toxic keep.
That's one that I think would be especially powerful viewed from the air, because what it essentially does is build something around the three-quarter mile square, which are enormous stone piles, really, shaped like zigzag, like lightning or radiation, coming out of this square. Some of these things are 800 or 1,000 feet long, and they trail out to kind of sharp points, but up close, they really have fairly high tops, 50 to 60 feet high. Because the faces that face in on the kind of dangerous area are big, these earthworks somehow crowd in on you and they cut off the horizon. And essentially you feel lost in the desert in this kind of massive thing.
The landscapes are not intended to be works of genius. Brill wants to discourage future generations from moving the objects or placing them in a museum. By drawing the curiosity seekers, Brill says, the landscapes will continue to proclaim their message for generations upon generations.
If this place were considered one of the seven wonders of the world, and there was a constant flow of tourists from the day it was closed, not only would you get the message from the place itself, but you would have a kind of constant flow of tourists and visitors' guides and people knowing what this place is and why it looks like that. So, on the contrary, any kind of constant activity at the site would be fine, just as long as it wasn't inhabitation or drilling.
Michael Brill is a professor of architecture at the State University of New York at Buffalo and director of BOSTI, the Buffalo Organization for Social and Technological Innovation, a nonprofit design research organization. Brill says it is unfortunate that humans are producing materials that need a 10,000-year-long warning, but he is encouraged to see toxic waste production slowing down as the Cold War ends. The 500,000 barrels of toxic waste, now stored at various locations around the nation, will be buried deep beneath the desert in Carlsbad, New Mexico, part of the Waste Isolation Pilot Program, or WIP. With time needed for public comment and an environmental impact study, Brill predicts it will be several years before the waste could be placed in the keep. He admits that some damage has already been done to the future, but he hopes that menacing boulders and massive spikes will protect and educate our unsuspecting descendants. This is Bruce Robertson.
Habitat is home. and our fellow creatures are losing theirs at a dangerously accelerating rate. During our lifetime, perhaps 1 million unique species of animal and plant life will disappear. Lost forever.
So begins a video documentary titled A Stitch in Time, Saving the Last Great Places. Narrated by ABC News anchor Peter Jennings, the video is a production of the Nature Conservancy in Arlington, Virginia. In the last 40 years, the Nature Conservancy, one of the most cost-effective environmental organizations, has acquired and preserved over 6.5 million acres of wildlife habitat. The Last Great Places project represents a new tactic as the Conservancy attempts to expand its sphere of protection.
We realize that it's not good enough just to buy relatively small parcels of land and either literally or figuratively fence them off.
Ronald Getz, spokesman for the Nature Conservancy.
In the course of our own development, we've realized that what happens around those, let's call them core natural areas, can have a very dramatic impact on what happens inside.
Getz says whether a habitat remains healthy well into the next century depends on how well we focus now on the larger picture, seeing the habitat as part of a system of habitats. But, says Getz, this raises a new set of concerns.
We also recognize that you can't just buy up land indefinitely, that people live on these in these areas. Their livelihoods are dependent on them. So we needed to come up with ways that we could protect habitat while also accommodating human economic needs. And I think that's really the key to this Last Great Places initiative.
A last great place is not a single site. It would not be possible, say, to look at one from a scenic overlook. These locations are integrated systems. So far, the Nature Conservancy has designated 12 such systems in the Western Hemisphere. Of the 12, says Getz, 8 are in the United States, the oldest being the Virginia Coast Reserve.
The core of which is 14 barrier islands on the Virginia coast. And now we're working in areas on the mainland to ensure that these barrier islands remain pristine and can support the rare and endangered species that live there. Also on the East Coast is Block Island off the coast of Rhode Island, and we're linking that up with our work on Long Island in New York, especially on the eastern end, which is called the Peconic region, and it leads right into Block Island, so we're sort of treating that as a single unit.
Also on the East Coast are the Florida Keys, the only barrier reef system in the continental United States. Not only an important fish habitat, but supporting a fishing and shellfish industry. The region is a critical economic resource.
If we start going into the middle part of the country, there's the Tallgrass Prairie Project in Osage County, Oklahoma, which is our attempt to restore a fully functioning tall grass ecosystem, which essentially is extinct as a functioning ecosystem in North America. So this is really putting back together an ecosystem that had been destroyed. And next year we'll be reintroducing bison as one of the important components of this ecosystem.
The fifth great place is known as the Big Darby Creek, a watershed just outside Columbus, Ohio.
There, it's one of the most important and most pristine water systems in the Midwest. And we're working not just to acquire land, but working with the farmers who have farms that are in the watershed so that we can develop more efficient farming practices that will be both economically viable for the farmers, but will ease the erosion of soil into the Big Darby Creek, which is the main threat right now to the aquatic species there.
The Texas Hill Country between Austin and San Antonio represents the sixth place. In the desert southwest lies the seventh great place, here truly a system. The San Pedro River ecosystem in the southeastern portion of Arizona, and just over the border in New Mexico, the Gray Ranch,
which we purchased a couple years ago and remains the largest single private purchase for conservation. And this is an entire ecosystem. It has its own mountain range in the middle. It's 500 square miles. And it was about to be sold by its previous owner. And we saw an opportunity here to, one, prevent this important system from being broken up into smaller parts. But one thing that we're very eager to do at the Gray Ranch is to continue cattle grazing, which is an important part of the economy there. And we want to create a model to show that you can have grazing while protecting important natural elements and endangered species at the same time.
The San Pedro River is a rare desert river with aquatic species and land-based animals dependent on the river water. Along the California coast is the eighth last great place.
Napomo Dunes, it's actually now called Guadalupe Napomo Dunes. It's really two dune systems, and it's one of the last undeveloped stretches of California coastline. And it's a real model of how a diversity of interests can come together and work together. In this case, we have a partnership with the Department of Defense. We're working with Vandenberg Air Force Base in a very productive way. Their staff and our staff are collaborating to do inventories of the property, so we really know what species are there and what their requirements are. We're even working with an off-road vehicle association so that there can still be recreational uses while the more fragile areas of this ecosystem are protected.
Just as each last great place is not a single site, so is the process by which the region is protected not a single act. The Nature Conservancy, the catalyst or the mediator, bringing together various elements, private developers, industry, scientific projects, public government lands, and those urging strict environmental protection. Using as an example, the Virginia Coast Reserve, Goetz describes how it is possible to accomplish a great deal with relatively little money.
We saw what the threat could become on the mainland. So what we started doing was buying up some of the coastline, knowing that we couldn't afford to hold that land forever, nor could we reasonably consider just constantly buying further inland forever. That's just, you know, impossible. So what we've looked at is buying some of this land, which right now is largely farmland, and putting a conservation easement so that land either won't be developed or we can determine what density it could be developed at. And then we sell it back to private owners with those restrictions. And it then alleviates some of the financial burden we have because we've been able to sell this land back to the private owners.
Even still, the whole process at each site does take years and lots of money to accomplish. Goetz says the Conservancy recently received a $1 million grant from Miller Brewing Company to be used in the Last Great Places campaign. In coming weeks, we will visit each of the designated sites for a closer look. Ronald Goetz is Director of Communications for the Nature Conservancy in Arlington, Virginia. The organization will announce in March of 1993 that more than 60 new sites around the world will be designated, including regions in Indonesia and the Pacific Islands. This is Bruce Robertson. There is a new book available from Delia and Mark Owens, author of Cry of the Kalahari.
Standing on an old tea crate cupboard, I pull myself up to the sill and see Survivor's eye only a foot away. Long, straight lashes partially cover his pupil as he looks toward the ground searching for a fruit. Then, as he picks one up with his trunk and puts it into his mouth, he lifts his lashes and looks directly at me. He shows neither surprise nor concern, and I stare into the gray forever of an elephant's eye.
Delia Owens reading from her new book, The Eye of the Elephant, set in the North Luangwa Valley of Zambia. She continues.
In the last 15 years, 100,000 elephants have been slaughtered by the poachers in this valley. Here, elephants usually run at the first sight or scent of man. I want to remember always the deep furrows of folded skin above survivor's lashes, his moist and glistening eye, which now reflects the sunrise. Surely this will never happen to me again. The memory must last a lifetime, and I must never forget the way I feel, for at this moment I can see everything so clearly.
Delia, you wrote this, and so begins your book. This happened to you, actually, but what did you mean when you say you can see everything so clearly?
Bruce, we had been working in this national park at that stage for about 5 years in northern Zambia to stop the poaching. And when we first arrived there, the elephants were being shot at the rate of 1,000 a year. And finally, we had one group of elephants that realized that our camp area was safe and they would come nearby. And this one male who had survived all the attacks, and the poacher's name was, we had named him Survivor. And he came into our camp from time to time. And this morning I had heard him feeding outside of our cottage. And when I crept up to the window and looked at his eye only 14 inches away, I felt like that I could see the hope. This one elephant had learned that he was safe. And I just felt like that there was hope that we could turn the situation around.
Since the 1970s, the elephant's population has decreased from around 1.6 million to 550,000. Writing elsewhere in the book, the authors describe finding some elephant bones. Five elephant skulls, bone white and half the size of bathtubs, are scattered about the area with pelvises, leg bones, ribs, shoulder blades, and other remains. Horrified, we notice skeletons lying everywhere. One here, five over there, six there. Hurrying from one skull to the next, we examine each one. All have small holes where small holes should not be in elephant skulls. All have had their faces chopped off, their tusks hacked away. Now we understand why we have not seen a single living elephant or a sign of one in the 8 days since we have entered the park. We are standing in the midst of a killing field where gangs of poachers have slaughtered every great gray beast they saw. It is an elephant's Auschwitz.
You can compare it, Bruce, to a drug cartel. The people selling drugs to the high school students in Miami in the inner cities of this entire country don't care that they are ruining the lives of these young people. It's the same with the poachers. They're shooting elephants for the ivory, and they don't care at all that the elephants will be gone someday. I mean, they just don't care.
Since 1989, there has been an international ban on the sale and trade of ivory under what is known as the Convention for the International Trade in Endangered Species. The price of ivory plummeted from $200 a pound to $1.36 a pound. The Owens have been successful halting the poaching for the most part because they have been able to offer alternatives.
Actually, what we've done is set up the carrot and the stick. We have taken on an aggressive stance to improve the anti-poaching by anti-poaching flights with the airplanes. Also, we've assisted the game guards, so they're now better at catching the poachers. And but then on the other side of it, we have gone to the people. We actually go to these little villages in the very remote places, and we go in and we say to them, look, we know that you're poaching. We haven't come here to arrest you. For any man who gives in his weapon, we will give you a job. So what we're doing is we're offering alternatives to the people so they don't have to poach. We're training men to be carpenters, giving them startup money so they can buy tools, and once they start making furniture and selling it for a profit, they have to pay us back. We use that money to go to another village and start a fish farm. We're starting a lot of little cottage industries that employ people so they can make money and they don't have to poach. Also, we emphasize projects that produce food, especially protein, so they have other sources of protein, fish farms, poultry units, and then the growing of crops that are high in protein, such as beans.
Delia, and along with her husband, Mark Owens, their new book, The Eye of the Elephant, available from Houghton Mifflin, New York, New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the reports. Our thanks to Karen Kelly for the story on the menacing landscapes. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 153. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.